Today we are going to continue our series that we started some weeks ago on the question, should I drink alcohol? We're using the Ben Franklin method of making that determination by listing all the risk and bad things that can happen from drinking alcohol, and then on the other side listing any good things that come from drinking alcohol and comparing the two lists. Our guest is Scott Stevens, and Scott, as you remember, is a journalist, and he posts regularly on health and alcohol issues for online news services and is a founding influencer at the world's largest medical portal, Health Tap. Scott has done research into this problem of alcohol, and he is an evidence-based researcher, so what you hear from him is backed up by science and not just by opinion. Scott has written 5 books. The one that's most recent is Look What Dragged the Cat In, The Rise in an Opioid Crisis. And Scott puts alcohol as the gateway drug to all the other drugs, so it's more important that we look at alcohol as far as should we drink it, because if it's the gateway drug to everything else, then maybe that's just one more thing that we're going to put on the negative side. And so let's see. Oh, the other thing I wanted to tell you, and I'll ask Scott about this, is can alcohol be the gateway drug to other addictions? And we'll get into that during this segment of the program. Scott, it's nice to have you on the program today.
Great. Thanks, Dr. Henderson. I'm glad to resume the conversation here. It's been great so far, and certainly, I hope, eye-opening for anybody who's considering their relationship with this drug.
Well, when we get through with this series, Scott, I don't see if the people look at all the negatives and they look at the positives, if there are any, that they can't come to the conclusion that any sane adult would make that it's not smart to drink alcohol. And if they're already addicted to it, then we can come from another direction and try to work on their problem with the disease of addiction itself. So I think this is going to be a big positive step, and that the more people that hear the programs, the better off the whole country will be. And so I'm just inviting everybody that's listening to Scott and I discuss this to tell your friends, and tell your friends that they can hear these programs by going to www.freedomfromaddiction.libsyn, and you spell Libsyn, LIBSYN.com. That link will take you directly to the podcast. Okay, so getting back to where we left off, I have the next thing to talk about is when people drank, liver cells began to produce substances and drinkers developed as a secondary result fatty liver disease, and that fat impairs liver function and can also cause scarring and eventually leads to liver failure, which often requires a transplant. Scott, what do you have to say about having to have a new liver as a result of drinking alcohol?
You know, the transplant list isn't getting longer, it's getting shorter. And you know, if I was to consider, you know, this toxin that I'm putting in my body has the potential to disable an essential organ for my life and my livelihood, to the point where I have to get on that the receiver list, that's a scary proposition, because there are people who are on that list that have been waiting for several months, and there are people who don't make it. They don't get the donor in time, and they die. And you know, that for me to drink my way on that list knowingly, you know, to consume this toxin with realization that here's a potential outcome, to do that with a sound mind is not likely. Why put yourself in that position? And not everybody who consumes alcohol is going to get to that point. Certainly the risk of fatty liver disease, cirrhosis, any of the types of alcohol-related liver problems, you know, they're going to go up with the more you drink. Well, you know, it all begins with the first one. And you know, you don't know from that first one if this is the outcome you can expect, and it isn't for everybody, but why chance it?
And another thing to think about is, besides the possibility of if you get on a transplant list, that you may not get a transplant before you die, the other thing is that not everybody that gets a transplant survives the operation. Transplanting livers is not an easy thing like doing an appendectomy. So there's more than one thing to think about here, and having to have a transplanted liver as a result of making the decision to drink alcohol is not smart.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at being making the list for a person who is referred for a liver transplant, you've got all sorts of things that come into play on that. And if you're still drinking, you're not going to make the list here. There are other things that go through the evaluation for liver transplant, having to deal with the complication of your disease, whether it's fatty liver or cirrhosis, you know, whether you've got a related carcinoma or related cancer around your liver, whether it's pancreatic or liver. Some of your blood test scores come into play here as well. But if you're still drinking, you're not going to make the list. And, you know, that's unfortunate. You know, that may seem heavy-handed to say to a person with the disease of alcoholism, to say, well, because you have another disease that you're not treating, we're not going to put you on this list for the disease related to the disease you already have. So it's a dual-edged sword, but you can avoid both edges.
Okay, so on my list, on the left-hand side under risk, I'm putting risking a liver transplant. Mm-hmm. Next thing that I want to talk to Scott about is alcohol abuse is associated with increased risk of death in patients with community-acquired pneumonia despite treatment with antibiotics. Tell us about that, Scott.
Well, your immune system is compromised to begin with alcohol use. We were talking about that, I believe, in episode 5, where we're talking about T cells and the role that they play in fighting off infection and disease. So when you have pneumonia, essentially you have a backup, a bacterial backup, and you know this immune or compromised immune system isn't going to be able to handle that. So you're going to have a longer recovery time if you're able to recover fully. And you know it's a complicated relationship with lung illness and recovery time, but all of that ties into the compromise that you've put your immune system in to fight off things like pneumonia and to recover from pneumonia.
Okay, so increased risk from pneumonia goes on my list on the left. The next thing is alcohol doesn't just alter moods, it changes a drinker's appearance in the short and long haul. Alcohol dilates blood vessels, making the skin look red and blotchy quickly after drinking. It can make you look pale or colorless over time from vitamin depletion. Alcohol will cause dehydration, and if you already have dry skin, eczema, or psoriasis, drinking may worsen them. And any remedies for these conditions is nullified by drinking. So here's some dermatological reasons why you wouldn't want to drink.
Mm-hmm. And this part of the book, I really had to simplify it because there are all these relationships with different organs of your body, and here is your body's largest organ. And the liver size-wise is your largest internal organ, size-wise, weight-wise, mass-wise. But hey, your skin is your largest organ, and it's going to affect that organ as well. And the most obvious way we recognize damage to this organ is your appearance, how you look. There used to be an app called the Drink Mirror, and I'm not sure if it's still out there or not, but it'll show you how your body ages. And all these things that you just mentioned here, whether it's, blotchiness or looking pale or yellowish or colorless, and I think you also mentioned, with eczema and psoriasis, that as a result of alcohol being a drying agent, these things alter your appearance. They make you look older. This phrase, alcohol ages you, is no joke. It does age your skin. It ages the longevity of your organs for sure, but it's most obvious in your body's largest organ. You look at especially wrinkles. Your skin is very elastic, but you're also taking part of what makes that skin that elastic. Your body fluids, your body fluid balance, out of whack when you drink alcohol because of its role as a drying agent. So you're going to appear wrinkled. And by the way, you look at this phenomenon called mystery bruises. I mean, all of a sudden you can develop bruises. You think, well, I drank a lot last night. I don't kind of remember bumping into something. But it could be a sign of a much deeper level of damage because your compromised liver is going to lead to vitamin C depletion, and that is going to let you bruise without really having like a severe contact with a door frame or a bedpost or whatever you would ordinarily bump into to cause a bruise. These bruises, they appear out of nowhere because your body is so depleted and so compromised. And again, that's really a symptom further on down the road, but all these things that come into play with antioxidants, and if alcohol is depleting the antioxidants in your body, you're going to burn faster in the sun. That's going to make you look more wrinkled and bruised too. And there was a study, I can't remember if it was 2013, as it reported in the Dermatology Times, but okay. We have to look at where these antioxidants come from, fruits and vegetables. Well, notoriously, alcoholics don't necessarily flock to those food categories, and the body has dropped your antioxidant level within 8 minutes of drinking, and that depletion of antioxidants is going to be, it's going to hang around for at least an hour and a half, or until you consume the fruits and vegetables, the ones containing the antioxidants, to restore them in your body. So you're not doing your skin any favor. You're not doing your looks any favor by drinking alcohol in moderation or in mass quantities.
Also, because the liver is involved and because the liver's function is to detoxify, and as a result of it not being able to do its job, toxins build up. You get acne and anywhere on the body, not just on the face. And that was a new thing that I read in your book that I didn't know about previously.
Yeah, there are many ways that your body gets rid of toxins, and we could get rid of it in our excretion, whether it's urine, or feces. You can look at it also being excreted through the skin as sweat, and that's where this comes into play. Your skin is sweating out the toxins, and some of them that the liver hasn't even gotten a chance to get to. And when you have a toxin coming out of your pore, the likelihood of that pore becoming swollen closed to build up the pus behind it to create what we call zits. It's an ugly word, but it's an ugly thing, really. And if you can prevent a breakout, regardless of your age, you know, here I am, 52 years old, and you know, if you don't take care of your skin, and you get zits, and especially as I age, your body scars more easily because your skin over these decades has lost that elasticity. You know, an added scar to your face doesn't add character. It just says that, hey, I haven't been taking too good of care of myself.
Somebody said once, with respect to talking about alcoholics and their general overall physical looks and everything, and all the things that you've been talking about, the wrinkles and the skin burning and everything like that, they look like they've been ridden hard and put away wet.
Yeah.
I remember that. I don't know where I got it from, but that kind of brings up a picture in my memory of what some of the chronic alcoholics that I've treated in the past look like. And obviously nobody wants to look like that they've been ridden hard and put away wet, so I would put that on my risk list. It's not something that's going to kill you, but it's not something that you're going to like either. You know,
also playing into that win is, you know, we talked earlier on in one of the episodes about how alcohol affects your sleep. And people who have chronic alcohol use, you notice they have those bags under their eyes because they're not getting the quality sleep. And, you know, that we say, oh, you look like you're carrying extra bags today. Well, you know, the reason for that is when you don't get the quality sleep, the REM sleep, to rejuvenate your body, you know, it shows in a person's eyes, and especially in those bags. So, you know, wrinkles aside, all the other complications, a little bit of jaundice is obviously a sign that things are really bad. But even the bags under your eyes after a binge drinking episode, or just maybe having a few too many. And in my book, of course, one is probably way too many because of all these other complications we talk about. But those bags are a good sign that you're not doing yourself any favors.
Another thing that you talked about, you said your eyes have been called the windows to the soul, but they are also windows to your drinking activities. And then you talked about a test that... I don't know if the police do it or not, but other than trying to walk a chalk line, it's called the nystagmus gaze test, and a test that no impaired driver can cheat. Tell us what that is, Scott.
So that's when they hold a pen, I guess about 18 inches or so away from the front of your face, and they move it far to one side. They tell you to follow it with your eyes, and follow it, and then they move it far to the opposite side, and they watch their eyes. Now, as something moves to the periphery of your eyes, when you're under the influence, your eye is going to have a twitching or a jerking to it, and that is, you know, without an alcohol test, you know, blowing into the machine in the field of the field sobriety tests are typically, okay, touch your nose, do the ABCs, walk heel toe, like you said, in a straight line, and then this nystagmus gaze test. You know, they're going to do all of those things before they make you blow into a field breathalyzer. And those field breathalyzers are notoriously unreliable, which is why that if you blow anything close to the limit, the legal limit for driving, 0.08 in most states, 0.05 in Utah, you're going to be brought into the station for a more accurate reading on a piece of machinery that is calibrated more more exactly and isn't subject to bouncing around in the car's glove box. But that nystagmus gaze test, I mean, if you're barely impaired, and again, impairment begins at the very first drink, you know, you can probably pull off the ABCs at 52. I think I've said them a few times. But in the nose touching, you know where that sniffer is on the front of your face. Walking heel to toe, even a person with an extremely high tolerance, they're used to walking. They're used to faking it. So they can probably get away with that one. The nystagmus gaze test, that is completely involuntary twitching that happens when your body is under the influence at the periphery of your vision. When you try to follow that pen all the way to the left or to the right, you can't control that. No matter how many years of drinking experience you've had, once you approach that questionable mark of intoxication for driving, they're going to haul you in. They're at least going to pull out the field breath test and see where you're at, see if it warrants bringing you in. But the nystagmus gaze test, you're not going to bluff that one.
And everybody knows, either by personal experience or by the experience of friends and relatives, that getting a DUI is expensive in many different ways, and it's not something that a person wants to accumulate, even one. So you think, I would put this on the left-hand side of my Franklin T-chart, that one of the risks of drinking is getting DUIs.
Without question.
Yeah, the next thing you talked about, optic neuropathy, and related to tobacco or alcohol, giving you amblyopia or lazy eye. Those are some fancy terms, but basically alcohol hurts your back of your eye in the optic center, right?
Yeah, there's, when we think about the eyes and somebody is drinking, you say, oh, your eyes are glassy and your eyes are red, but, you know, that's just the outward appearance to it. The damage that goes on to create that is so many interactions with your visual cortex, which is located at the back of the brain. You know, you can do some long-term damage over time with drinking that will decrease. I mean, this blurry vision that you have when you're drinking, that could become a permanent side effect due to damage to the cortex at the back of your brain. But you also have decreased vision, whether it's color vision or night vision. So when you're driving, it could be tunnel vision. It could be increased sensitivity to the oncoming headlights because your pupil can't dilate or contract fast enough. And the optic neuropathy is a real, that's a noticeable long-term one, because lazy eye, you can tell. I mean, you can see that one eye isn't tracking with the other. And that's another piece that, again, when this is an ugly long-term thing that that will happen to a person with a damaging relationship with this toxin. And you know, if you don't have glasses, you might need them the more you drink, or if you already have them, you might be looking at thicker ones or an increased power of the prescription for your contact lenses as a result of what this toxin is doing to the muscles within the eye. Remember, it creates long-term damage in your muscle. It was a very, very powerful conversation when we were talking about the heart, your body's most important muscle, but there are muscles, hundreds of muscles inside your eye that help you see the world, and you're damaging that muscle as much as you're damaging the heart.
Now, the next thing that we're going to take up is going to be something that will be extremely important to men especially. So all you men out there, listen up. Drinking alcohol can cause lasting damage to a man's sexual performance which is called erectile dysfunction, and even after abstaining from booze for more than a year, heavy drinkers tend to enjoy sex less and less often than those who don't drink. Now, if that isn't something that you want to put on the left side of your chart by risk and bad things, I don't know what is.
Whew, for some people, that would be pretty close to the top of the list, too. I mean, this is part of the human experience. This is part of enjoying life. And if you need a little blue pill to pull it off, you might want to look at how your relationship with alcohol has contributed to that. Now, certainly not all ED is going to be alcohol or drug-related. You know, there are other biological causes to and some neurological reasons for erectile dysfunction, and some psychological that are purely psychological. But here's one that we can eliminate very easily, because alcohol, and this was a Spanish study that looked at overall, I mean, the pleasure, the enjoyment of the event, and the ability to last, or, you know, like you said, the droop was there for more than a year after somebody stopped dumping toxin on top of their libido. It's not an easy conversation, certainly. But you know, if it's alcohol related, you know, before you go reaching for that little blue pill, you might want to just knock off the alcohol and see how that does for you. And you know, just reducing drinking, you might think, well, okay, maybe that's it, I'll just cut back. No, the alcohol starts its effect. There's the derogatory term, whiskey, and fill in the blank here. Well, you know, it doesn't just come from whiskey, and it doesn't come just from drinking a lot of it. It starts with that first drink again. So, you know, there are performance problems here because of this drug, and a lot of it ties into its impact on muscle, which we just talked about, and also that it's a central nervous system depressant.
Well, I'm getting depressed talking about all the bad things that alcohol does for you. Let's talk for a second. Does alcohol do anything good for you? I think we said, and we put on our right-hand side of our list, that it was a social lubricant. It might make you be able to feel like that you function better in society. And we said it might relieve stress, although that's kind of debatable. And it's self-medication for pain, which is probably not a good thing to do anyway. And some people use it as a self-medication for sleep, but we talked about just a minute ago how it impacts REM sleep, so even though you might go to sleep faster, you wake up, so not all that great there. Those are some of the things that I remember from our previous conversations. Can you think of anything right off the top of your head that you'd put on the right side for a reason that you would think that alcohol would be good for you to drink?
Not unless you find making a complete fool of yourself. and on the plus side, I mean, some people might find you more funny. You certainly think you're more funny, but that's the alcohol talking. In the way that we look at it with Look What Dragged the Cat In and throughout my other four books, is that are any of these benefits, and I'll tell you, I struggled with insomnia for years, and you might think anything that can just put me to sleep has got to be marked as a very, very strong benefit. But is anything worth that risk? All these other risks that we're talking about, you wonder, okay, is it really, is that extra hour that I get to sleep worth the loss of the REM sleep that I've had, and all the other corresponding damage, even when it's not sleep-related. If it's erectile dysfunction, if it's increased risk of any of the other things on the minus side of the chart, including drinking and driving and getting that very expensive ticket, you know, those benefits really seem pretty pale.
Absolutely. Well, we've been talking for the last half hour with Scott Stevens, and this was the number 6 segment of this series, and we will be back with number 7 soon. And so, Scott, thanks again for this, and they can get your book, Look What Dragged the Cat In, at Amazon, right? And see on a more on a deeper level than what we've hit, if you want to hear the facts and the research on a deeper level. Scott, thanks so much for being on the program today.
I appreciate it, Dr. Henderson. Thanks for the opportunity, and look forward to part 7.